From McMaster University, I'm John Preston, and you're listening to Big Ideas for a Changing World. In this series, you'll hear from researchers from McMaster's Faculty of Engineering and beyond, who are creating innovative solutions to our world's greatest challenges. I have the chance to see some of these solutions up close as the faculty's Associate Dean of Research and External Relations. The challenge we'll explore today is the global sprint to create an accurate antibody test for SARS-CoV-2, the strain of coronavirus that causes COVID-19. This is a complex topic of research, and we'll delve into the importance of creating a test that does not give false positive results, and if a test like this could be useful in other applications. Ishwar Puri, Dean of Engineering, and Research Associate Rakesh Sahu will give us a glimpse into the road to creating their very own rapid detection kit for SARS-CoV-2 antibodies. As you'll hear, they're launching a startup company to bring this innovation and others to market, including a 3D cell and tissue printing technology developed right here at McMaster. With that, a warm welcome to Ishwar and Rakesh on Big Ideas for a Changing World.
Thank you for having us, John. I'm Ishwar Puri. I'm a professor in the Faculty of Engineering, and thanks to the generosity of federal and provincial funding agencies and several industrial sponsors, I'm also privileged to lead a robust research group.
Thank you for having us here, and hello everyone. I'm Rakesh Sahu. I'm a research associate in the Department of Mechanical Engineering and have an adjunct appointment at the Material Science Department in McMaster University.
So I'm aware that since March, both of you have been working literally around the clock on actually a broad number of research projects related to COVID-19. Can you tell me the connection? Are these a straightforward continuation of the type of research you were doing before the pandemic?
There was a very rapid pivot towards COVID-19. These were certainly not our core competencies before the pandemic hit. However, we were able to leverage what we were doing before. We were working with human cells, we were working with bacteria, and we were working on sensors that work on something called antigen-antibody binding. When we looked at the pandemic, the SARS-CoV-2 virus and its detection rely on pretty much the same principles. And so we found that it was relatively simple to pivot. But time was of the essence. And so you're quite right. We did a very rapid sprint to develop a rapid detection kit for SARS-CoV-2 antibodies, which can be used for those who are infected or those who are recovering from the infection, and if they are asymptomatic or they're showing symptoms.
So Rakesh, can you tell us a little bit more about this rapid detection system, how it works, how the various pieces of it come together?
What we have learned over this time is whenever somebody gets infected with SARS-CoV-2, the immune system tries to fight back, and in the process, the body generates antibodies. And these antibodies are the proteins, molecules that fight back the infection. So the presence of these antibodies within an individual indicates the prior or a current infection. What we are developing over the last few months is a rapid detection kit that can tell an individual if they have these antibodies from the SARS-CoV-2 virus. We have transformed a conventional lab-based serological test, which is considered to be a gold standard, and into a user-friendly format. So the device which we are building up consists of the synthetic SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, the proteins that are present on the surface of the viruses, and some other reagents. So an individual who will be performing the test would basically draw some sample of blood using a lancet and put this into the device. And there are subsequent steps following which the individual would be able to see a color change in the device. If there is a color change from a clear liquid to blue or yellow, this indicates that the individual sample contains the antibodies from SARS-CoV-2 infection. Currently, we are developing this device for the blood sample. However, we are also developing the same device for a saliva-based sample, which would be more non-invasive for an individual to test upon. And the basic principle remains the same, but it's just the sample type which will differ in these two different type of device. So this test, eventually what it does is it can be shipped to an individual as a device, as a packet, and the individual can perform this test without the knowledge of the basic principle and the science behind it, with just following the simple guidelines and protocols.
So antibody-based testing has had mixed reviews to date. A number of tests have been rushed to market. My understanding is that probably the biggest challenge with them is either a lack of sensitivity, or in particular, that leading to the challenge with false positives. Is there a strategy built into your approach to address those weaknesses?
Thank you for identifying the challenges, John. You're bang on target. There was a study done, I think about a month ago, about 14 tests in the United States where they found that 13 were inaccurate. The 14th one was not 100% accurate, but it was accurate. So we immediately seized upon this as a challenge. Our test does not give false positives, and we've paid special attention to sensitivity. The antibodies that an infected person may have may vary from person to person, and they also vary with time. They build up initially as the infection is ongoing, and then after a while, the antibody count starts to fall. So the sensitivity of the test is very important. And you're quite right about specificity. So we've run several different experiments to make sure that our test is quite specific. So what we feel right now is that we have a product that is more sensitive and more specific than other products on the market. And it also is a product that doesn't give false positives, because you wouldn't want to give somebody confidence that falsely that they might have antibodies, and they might then think that they might be immune to SARS-CoV-2 infection, and that they might be able to indulge in certain behaviors which are undesirable. I must hasten here to add that there is no evidence right now that once infected, a person is going to have immunity for long durations or any immunity at all to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. The inference, of course, is that for most viral diseases, people develop an immunity. And so that's the inference that many people are going on, but there is no scientific evidence as yet.
You've said that this test will not have the false positives that have plagued some of the earlier tests. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about the mechanism of how your test has been able to achieve that?
When we developed the tests, we used donor blood and we spiked it with SARS-CoV-2 antibodies. Now, donor blood from several donors had other biological material in it, including antibodies, because those donors may have been exposed to other kinds of viruses and other kinds of diseases. The method that we use is so robust that we're able to wash away everything else other than the SARS-CoV-2 antibodies, which then bind to our test kit. And in binding to our test kit, they bring about a color change that we're able to detect. The innovation here is the method of binding and the method of washing, which hasn't been the norm in competitive tests that are already on the market.
So Ishwar, it's been just a few months from conception to where you are now. And you posed an initial challenge to try to get this to market in time to have an impact. Can you maybe comment on how you try to accelerate the rate at which innovation can take place?
So this was a sprint, and the sprint involved a pivot. We used our background in biosensing to come up with a detection kit, which is essentially a sensor. The challenge here was that with biosensing, you can be very fancy with environmental sensors. You can have all kinds of gizmos and power supplies, and you could slap on software, measure currents. There are many ways of doing this. With a home kit, it has to be very simple. It has to be simple to use. The simplest home kit to use would be a saliva sample. We started off with that, but we very rapidly found out that blood samples might be appropriate as well, because all you need is a very small amount of blood, firstly. And secondly, the antibody content in blood might be higher. So it involved learning a lot about physiology and also talking to people. It also meant monitoring the markets for the kinds of tests that were coming in and keeping a handle on the literature. The literature on SARS-CoV-2 has literally exploded. And so it was a true sprint where we literally worked night and day because experiments had to be scheduled with social distancing, making sure that we adhered to safe guidelines that we weren't really infecting each other in case we had COVID-19, and just learning on the fly. So it's been 2 months, and in 2 months now we have a working prototype. We've passed that on to a startup. We founded the startup, and today we gave our first pitch. We also thought about pivoting, because you can get pipped at the post. There's a lot of interest in SARS-CoV-2 antibody testing, and there are others who are also sprinting. I already explained the advantages of our kit, but it is possible that others may come out a little ahead of us with similar advantages. So what we've also thought about is a pivot in the market. Now that we have a rapid detection kit for a virus, we can pivot from SARS-CoV-2 to any viral infection. And one of the markets that we are currently investigating is the poultry market, where there is a virus that poultry, particularly chicken, can get, which can be very debilitating. And that's a huge market, which is about a $200 million market for testing in the United States itself. So regardless of SARS-CoV-2, the point I'm making is that when you sprint and you have the ability to pivot, there are many other uses for a technology or a product that become immediately apparent, so that if the product is too late or is not accepted by one particular market, there are other markets that you can apply the product to, because there are three things that we look for: faster, cheaper, better. Our product is faster, it's cheaper, and we have to establish with competition that it is also better. Two out of three is good enough. Three out of three of faster, cheaper, better is a home run. We are hoping to hit the home run.
That's awesome. It's often said that necessity is the mother of invention. And if nothing else, this pandemic has presented numerous necessities, things that we absolutely have to do. Do you think it's changed the way you're going to be conducting research for the rest of your career?
Yeah, absolutely. In the last couple of months, apart from the usual research that our group was conducting, I have been involved into several other research projects. Apart from the one which we're discussing today is the COVID-19 detection kit, I was involved into a mask project that's an initiative from the Faculty of Engineering. I was involved into a research project that was making advanced nanoparticles that can actually detect the SARS-CoV-2 virus in hospitals for high throughput screening. So in all these projects, I have used my previous expertise, and all the projects required sprinting, as was earlier mentioned, that we have to like work right to the objective and to achieve those in given time. We haven't done that before in our research projects. Yeah, we have some objectives. We have some deadlines for submissions and stuff, but we had never sprinted towards achieving a product that will facilitate problem solving. So this is something what I have learned in the last couple of months, and surely that this will change the course of thinking whenever I'm going to develop a new research project or I'm going to get into managing a research project. How to make things faster, or why are we doing this, and how to make it into something which is useful, not just for the sake of the research.
Ishwar, you're not only a professor at McMaster Engineering, you're also the dean. So putting on your decanal hat and listening to what Rakesh has been telling us about this new methodology for conducting research, do you see this as potentially spreading to non-COVID related type of research activities? And maybe changing the paradigm that society has of and their view of how academics work on problems?
I anticipate that that would be the case, John. I think sprints are appropriate for certain things, whereas very deep, deliberative research is appropriate in other circumstances. It's just that our old paradigm was always to deliberate and to sink deep into projects. Sprinting in research, or particularly academic research, has been a new concept for some people. And I think that if we are going to be engineers who are going to address societal problems, grand challenges, the UN Sustainable Development Goals, then I think that sprinting is another arrow in our quiver. It is another tool that we have. And learning how to sprint has not only been good for the researchers who are relatively advanced or who have PhDs, but I think that this has been a tremendous experience in innovation and in innovation-based thinking for the graduate students and the undergraduate students who've been involved, because they've participated in the sprint, and many of them have been part of discussions around the sprint. So I think in terms of changing culture and attitude, this has been a very, very powerful experience, which I think holds lessons for the future. And I hope that those lessons will disseminate themselves appropriately.
Frankly, I'm quite amazed that you've been able to come so far so fast in terms of verifying the effectiveness of the test. Can you talk about how you've been able to accelerate things? I would have thought that just the idea of getting clinical trials arranged would have taken months. And yet, how have you been able to get test results so quickly?
It's the best part of McMaster University. It says collaborate, right? So we love in collaboration. And eventually what happened in the last couple of months, because of my involvement in other different projects, it happened that I was working with a pathologist in a hospital around McMaster University. And while we were doing this test with our detection kit, we had this notion, okay, we are using these commercial available antibodies and introducing them into the blood. But can we test them with the actual clinical samples from the patient? And then I just reached out to one of the doctors in the health science department of the St. Joseph Hospital. And he was generous enough to say that, yeah, they do have samples and we will be able to use those samples for testing purposes. But we have to just work around the paperwork and get permissions. So that is something which we are going to do before we start the clinical trials, because we are a research lab. We don't have that resources to conduct those clinical trials at our own facility. So we are relying on the expertise and the resources available to our friends nearby, and which is in this case, strategically, we have these friends at our arm's length that can help us in providing the samples that we can test with our kit.
In addition to the serology testing for antibodies, you're both working on a 3D cell printing technology that could be used for drug testing for diseases, including COVID-19. This has recently been published in various journals. Can you tell us a little bit more about how this actually works?
Sure, John. We've been working on this particular project for several years now, and we have some of the leading work in the world in the field of 3D printing, which is magnetically assisted. In our case, we don't insert anything into cells. Typically, what people have done before is that they've inserted magnetic nanoparticles into cells and then they've agglomerated them or organized them in a particular way. We don't do that. Instead, what we do is use a concept that's very simple. So it's a concept like buoyancy. In buoyancy, hot air rises, cold air falls. What we do is we introduce cells which are not very magnetic in a culture medium that is magnetic. And once the cells grow in that medium, what we do is using magnetic arrangements, we're able to move the magnetic medium into a particular place so that the cells actually agglomerate, self-assemble in areas where the magnetic field is not as strong. And by separating the culture media from the cells in such a way, we're able to isolate cells into certain regions, print layers of cells, different cells on top of each other, and also print surrogates for wounds, where you could use drugs, for instance, to see how those wounds might heal. And so the advantage of this method is that typically the fastest methods today, which can do 3D printing of cells and tissues, these methods take anywhere from 3 days to a few weeks in order to print the cells. We're able to shorten that entire process into 3 hours. So imagine the productivity. We've also found a way to automate the process. So for instance, if we integrate robotics into our process, we can print literally hundreds or thousands of these self-assembled cells and tissues in a matter of 3 hours. So it's a very, very powerful method, and it's one that we want to bring to market.
So Ishwar, you've initiated within your research group a startup to take this idea to market. Can you tell me a little bit about what's the strategy, what's the vision, and what's the rationale for doing that as opposed to perhaps licensing to an existing company?
That's a good question, John. We have a startup, and the basis of the startup is that we'd like to take the products of our research to market. Right now, we have two products. The sprint taught us a lot about developing minimum viable products. And for the second product, it's based on some research that has been ongoing in our lab for a while. It's a rapid 3D printer for cells and tissues so that you could perhaps print skin grafts, for instance, or you could print cancer tumors for drug screening, toxicology, basic research, and so on. So a variety of different uses. What we've done is, after producing these minimum viable products, we've started making pitches to various individuals to find the best way to go to market. We've also done an investigation of the market, and we also have a handle right now on how much the material costs would be to make these two products, which gives us an idea of what the overhead would be in terms of marketing, sales, and so on, so that these products can be priced appropriately when they enter the market. This is a nascent effort, and what we hope to do is do user testing and dynamic design and customer discovery. So for one of the products, we are actually right now in the process of customer discovery, where we are pitching the product and seeing if customers have any ideas for us. Following that, we'll very rapidly do user testing for these products to make sure that they're ergonomic, that the users have no problems in using them. These shouldn't be products that come with 50-page manuals. They should be very self-apparent and ready to use at the get-go once they're unpackaged. We're reasonably hopeful with the team that we have that we will have a CEO and a CTO in place in short order so that these products can indeed go to market by the end of the year or starting early next year. The rapid detection kit might come out a little faster than that. The rapid 3D printer for cells and tissue might take a little longer.
One of the big challenges, Rakesh, is going to be predicting and measuring a second wave if we experience that in Ontario and Canada. Can your test kit have a role in that?
I have been to a situation. 2 months ago, I went for getting myself tested for SARS-CoV-2. And my partner was hesitant in sending me, in allowing me to visit this assessment center. So given a second wave may come, people would prefer to get themselves tested for the infection at their house without leaving and going to the assessment center. So yes, if the second wave happens, our kit would play a big role in that if we can basically deliver them or ship it out to the people who wants to get themselves tested at their own house.
So thank you so much for sharing your journey on this podcast. Any final thoughts of where this is likely to end and take you?
I would like to emphasize that these are not just a product. These are platforms which could be translated into addressing different solutions based on the need. So we are addressing the need right now. And as the situation demands, we can use the same platform to address the other needs. So it's just a beginning. And finally, I would like to thank our diverse and exciting team members who have played a significant role in the last couple of months and throughout a couple of years on developing both the products as well.
What I would say is that it's really exciting working at a world-class university which has such a collegial and collaborative view of research. Our research has been enriched tremendously. While Rakesh and I are here today, there's a very deep bench behind us of people who've enriched our thinking. And these are, of course, members of our group, other faculty members who are part of our group, and we're part of their group, graduate students, undergraduate students, postdocs, and so on. But we've also been enriched by the very easy discourse that takes place on this campus in discussions, not only with colleagues within the Faculty of Engineering, but colleagues across the university. I think that this is a very special characteristic of McMaster, and it's also a very special characteristic of Canada, where one is able to reach out to individuals at other institutions in private companies and have conversations, forge relationships that can then lead to exciting projects, other forms of funding, startup ideas. We hope we'll be successful. The point I'm saying is that the journey has been very enriching. And if the journey is any indication of future success, I think the future is very bright.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Big Ideas for a Changing World. This show was produced by Jesse Park and edited by Dan Kim. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or let us know your thoughts on social media. We're at McMaster Engineering on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. See you next time.